Good evening, James McKenney here with my Science Hour, September 18th, 2014. And tonight I'll be talking about comets, getting back to the topic of comets, electrical conditions in the solar system, etc. And I will be talking about some aspects of the new book, expanding on some topics that are covered in the book with some greater detail. I'll be talking about the hurricane season, which is kind of strange this year. A lot of activity in the Pacific Ocean. And some other commentary before the main science topic, once again talking a bit about comets, upcoming events, and then some other topics related to the new book. Hurricane activity, very strange. We had a hurricane classified as a hurricane. I don't really know myself, but very marginal. It swung up in the middle of the central Atlantic Ocean and is heading off easterly. This year has really been a dud of a year, which is exactly what I predicted. Now, if you remember back in June, the National Hurricane Prediction Center came out and said this would be a pretty big year for hurricanes, and I'm going, now what are they talking about? Based on what? So I examined it based on my view of the world, the electrical connections in the solar system which drive our weather systems, and it just wasn't there. The sun has been very weak. We had kind of a poof solar flare about a week ago, but as far as the entire overall season, just a pretty much of a nothing season as far as electrical conditions in the solar system. No major planetary alignments, just the typical small issues like new moons every month. But really, there's no reason for hurricane activity this year, and it's the resulting phenomenon relative to hurricanes is exactly that. It's a non-year. There's a bit of activity in the Pacific Ocean this year, and it's just very curious that there's nothing going on in the Atlantic but all of this activity out in the Pacific Ocean. I don't know. Could it be that we're seeing manipulated storm activity in the Pacific Ocean? I don't know. It's very curious. I can't say for sure, but it just seems very curious. But anyway, on to the next topic. The World Health Organization, I saw this about a week ago. I forgot to put it into last week's show, but they're talking about the process by which the World Health Organization goes into third world countries and tracks viruses, the spread of viruses like Ebola in Africa. And this woman, it was about this woman's activity where they trained her, and then she went into the field over in Africa, and her job, from the best I could tell, was to catch Ebola. But anyway, here's the process that this woman described. They go into the field, and somebody that is suspected of having the virus, they follow them for 21 days, noting who they come in contact with. Now, let's get real. A third world country, people are walking around the street, very poor hygiene, they're in crowded marketplaces and restaurants, or what we would call restaurants, but just food stands on the street. Sanitary conditions, like I say, really minimal. Sewer conditions, very minimal. But anyway, they follow these people for 21 days, and if after 21 days the suspected person comes down with symptoms of the virus or whatever the virus is, then they go back and they start to retrace and try and locate the people they came in contact with. But wait a minute. We're talking about communicable diseases here that are life-threatening, and these other people are off contacting people, the contactees are off contacting other people, off with their families, and nobody's following them around. So they go back and see if they can relocate these people that the initial guy had contact with. Now, this is a method which guarantees that the disease will be spread far and wide without any ability to truly track it. Now, this woman gets to her spot in Africa where she's supposed to be tracing the contactees, and lo and behold, she says all of the records are in chaos. Well, I mean, get a grip. It's very simple. The way you quarantine people, if they're suspected, if you have reason to believe they have a deadly virus, you quarantine them right now. You don't let them walk through society, the marketplace, the sewage region, the place where you get water, go home to their families. You don't let them do this for a period of 21 days and then go back. And then what are you going to do if you contact somebody that they were contacted? Go up and say, now we're going to... Then they start to follow those people for 21 days. It's a process that simply is designed to not work. You would have to be brain dead, stupid, I mean, to think that this process would somehow control the spread of a disease. Oh my goodness. I mean, this is just beyond belief, but this is the World Health Organization. And remember that it's becoming very clear that their role is to make sure these diseases get spread, and then the caseworkers out in the field, their part of the job is for them to contract whatever the disease is and then bring it back here. That's all I can say. I mean, it's just beyond belief. I mean, these people have to be so ridiculously stupid, or they're doing it on purpose to make sure that the disease spreads. And I would vote for number two, because nobody could be that ridiculously stupid as to promote a process like that. Just a quick note here. NASA, over the past year, since 2011, with the cancellation of the U.S. Space Shuttle program, has been sending astronauts to the U.S. International Space Station to the tune of $70 million per person, and they buy in groups of six with the Russian space program. So they're paying $42 million to send six people up to the space station, and then I imagine that includes bringing the other six back or whatever, or at least hopefully it's a round-trip ticket. Hopefully NASA is planning to bring them back. But at any rate, this is quite a good chunk of change, because the United States does not have the ability to put anybody into space, let alone a mouse, let alone anything else. They are trying to move towards privatization of this. And a guy named Elon Musk with his SpaceX program has been bringing supplies to the International Space Station, and I believe he has contracts out, they say, as far as 2017 for private ventures, satellites to put into space, etc. But this past week, SpaceX announced that it was suing the U.S. Air Force. And now this is interesting, because the U.S. Air Force has been giving out contracts to specifically Boeing, Lockheed Martin, kind of a joint venture of those major aerospace companies, the aerospace wing of Boeing and Lockheed Martin, to provide the access to outer space for various, this is for the U.S. Air Force needs. And so SpaceX is suing them, because the way the contracts are presented, it's impossible for the smaller corporations like SpaceX to get any of the dough. to get any of the contracts. So I find it very interesting that development. It just but it's the two halves of it. First of all, the Air Force, which is designed or contracted or bequeathed with the protection of us, and that would include from outer space, can't get a mouse into space, so they're trying to hire out to private contractors. Oh, this is just bizarre. Okay, now we've got two comet stories going on. In October, the sliding spring comet is called, is approaching Mars. And the whole issue is that something could happen there. A number of weeks ago, I described the scenario that I thought would happen, and I'll go into a little more detail on that today. But NASA came out, some of the boys at NASA, and they were obviously trying to head me off at the pass in the public press by making all of the same claims of things that could happen, including auroras, etc., all these phenomenal claims, but based on the Dirty Snowball Comet model, which obviously cannot cause any of these effects. And they said, the sky's the limit, anything could happen. Well, this past week, and this is very typical, they come out with a second set of stories, very conservative, saying that, no, nothing's going to happen. This comet's going to go by Mars. The faint little wispy tail isn't going to do anything, and nothing's going to happen. And there won't be any effects on the Mars orbiter, which has been repositioned to avoid any issues with this passing comet, but hopefully to take some observations, they say. But at any rate, we'll see what happens. But I just thought that was interesting. Also in the news this past week, the Rosetta mission from Europe, the European Space Agency, now selecting a landing site where they're going to land the first probe to ever land on a comet nucleus. So that ought to be very interesting. But once again, you can see that there's nothing in terms of water vapor belching out of this nucleus. Now, they mistake, and I know they're looking at these pictures, scratching whatever, trying to figure out what's going on because there's no water vapor coming off. That's supposed to be the impetus to blast dust and gases off the comet nucleus. They can see some dust and sand-like sprays coming off the nucleus. That's because the electron beam that's from the sunward side is basically starting to hit the nucleus. That's what causes that material to lift off of the nucleus. And once again, this is a very small comet, so you have to understand that big comets would have gravitational attraction, which would keep that material in its vicinity. And it's a whole different interaction if you have a big nucleus with significant gravitational field. But in a small comet, like the one they're looking at here, there's not sufficient gravitational attraction to hold this material once it gets blasted by the sunward side electron beam. Okay, so at any rate, let me go back to the sighting spring comet, and that is coming up here very soon. The expected passage date of this comet by Mars, the date will be October 19th, so about a month away here. And but the issue is we will not have any kind of view at this from our vantage point on Earth. We will basically be in daytime when this comet passage occurs. So really there's, unlike some comet issues in the past where we were able to observe Mars, the average person on the street or amateur astronomer will not be able to see anything relative to this this comet activity. So we're depending on some kind of reporting from NASA. I'll try and keep you posted. And as always, I have to read between the lines, interpret what is given to us, and see if we can eke any kind of real meaningful data out of what's handed to us from the official dogmas sent, news release centers of the official scientific community out there. Excuse me. So there's some other issues, just briefly mentioning, nobody's talking about the issues in Iceland. The volcanic activity there seems to be brewing, and it's hard once again to get real information. The local authorities seem to be quite concerned, and that's a story that I'm going to try and get some better first-hand data on before I start making major announcements on that. Okay, off to the new book once again. Now, this is a topic that really requires a bit of analysis. First of all, I want to say that I'm very pleased with the reaction that this book has gotten. And literally, it has gone all over the world, and it has gone into some fairly high-level places where these are engineers who are working with these kinds of issues. It's been a bit difficult for me to keep up with things over the past weeks because I've been busy in the background. I actually have another completely diverse project that I'm working on. And so, yeah, I'm quite busy. But part of the future is to deal with the reaction of the engineering world with the release of this book, Wing Generator. McCanny Wing Generator is the title of the book. Last week I talked about distributed energy, and tonight I want to talk about the scale of these large generators. First of all, I was on a show with Maria Heller. She's a talk show host out in Arizona. I'm a regular guest on her show now about once every couple weeks. I make an appearance there where we talk about real science. And I asked her on the air, I said, what do you think of when you think of alternative energy? When you hear that term, what goes through your mind? And she kind of thought for a minute, and I asked this specific question. Do you think, when you think of alternative energy, do you think of something that can take over and literally power our world? Or do you think of something insignificant, puny, not sufficient power to really do anything, possibly novelty ideas that may be fun to maybe throw some money at, do a little funding, but not a serious project that would really take over and solve our energy issues? And she goes, yeah, I don't think of alternative energy as being anything significant relative to the power generation that we experience, you know, with nuclear, coal, etc. And I said, yeah, well, that's an inbred assumption, like many things today. Let's take another assumption, that the economy is something you should be worried about, that the jobless rate or the other, you know, the stock market, or the housing start rate, all of these indicators that are used to somewhat put parameters or measurements on our society. And so, you know, there are so many false assumptions that are just drilled into people's heads from the time they're little. They assume that the jobless rate is important. When the government is lying through its teeth, they don't count the people that have been unemployed for more than 6 months. So how can it be called a jobless rate? It's absurd. Or the ridiculous statistics that 200,000 new jobs were created this last quarter, or whatever they say. I don't even listen to it. It's just absurd government chatter is all it is, because it is not based on any form of reality. The issue with alternative energy is we have been programmed, I haven't, but the majority of people have been programmed, to think of alternative energy as puny, insignificant, as I say, something that really cannot make a difference. And so what I try and promote in this book is the fact that, yes, there can be alternative energy solutions, but I also say that in the book, I actually go through all the various forms of alternative energy and one by one show you why they simply won't work. Using the single criteria, will this be sufficient to take over and power our entire energy needs with this so-called alternative energy solution? The things that I see being funded are non-solutions. Why is that? That's because they don't want solutions. They want to fund something so it can be put in a magazine. People will look at it and say, wow, we're making progress, when in reality, nothing that really ever would work would ever be funded. It would be scuttled, pushed out of the way. You know, it would be pushed into the background intentionally. And I've seen that personally, where the financiers and the people that I was working with to try and bring this wind generation system, or excuse me, I don't want to say wind, the wing generation system online. And all of a sudden, in each case, the failures that occurred basically in the financial end of the proposals. It's impossible to get anything going. And part of that, too, much of the failure that you see today in venture capital is simply due to the fact that venture capitalists do not understand engineering. The only thing they understand is a payback on investment. And today, the way venture capitalists work is, first of all, they try and find an idea. It doesn't have to work. It doesn't have to do anything, just like the three-blade wind generator. It does not have to perform. It doesn't have to do anything. But as long as you can go up to the government trough and get money out of it to come back and bring that into your business, that is deemed as successful business. That's why many of these alternative energy projects are funded, simply because somebody in government's going to write a blank check, hand it out, and it goes into the coffers of this newly formed corporation and makes it profitable by subsidies. Simple as that. And so the end result is that when people think of alternative energy, whether it's wind, the three-blade wind generator, or solar power, or geothermal, or the Carnot engine, the solar engines that are out in the middle of the desert that are killing millions of birds, or not millions maybe, but lots of birds, French frying them as they try and fly through the zone where these big mirror systems are set up. These systems are they are complete failures. But they're still profitable. They're still making money. They get that government handout. And so the end result is that the public has come to the conclusion, unwittingly, that alternative energy is puny, insignificant, won't work, and there's never even an assumption that it could ever come online and be what it's supposed to be, alternative energy, and provide us with real energy in the quantity that's necessary to drive our world. Another little side item here is that we simply use far too much energy, running back and forth to jobs that are meaningless, you know, keeping this job rate going, keeping the phony economy going that's based on maximum use of resources. You know, this kind of thing, it eventually is going to end. It cannot continue with countries like China or India coming on with collectively 3 billion people. The world simply doesn't have enough resources for these people to become middle class. There's enough resource in the world for everybody to live comfortably, to eat, to have clean water, and live on just a basic level. But to have everybody living in a three-bedroom, two-bathroom house in the suburbs just isn't going to happen. To provide them with clean water and the resources to build these structures for everybody simply isn't going to happen. A friend of mine just returned from China. They have cities over there that are in excess of 100 million people in a single city. You don't even know their names. The names of the city, just rows and rows and rows of skyscraper apartment buildings, and they don't have enough water, they don't have enough infrastructure to support these, but they have to put these people someplace. What do you do with 1.3 billion people? But anyway, back to the energy situation, the importance of scale, the ability to build these units large to the point where they can produce the same equivalent amount of energy as a nuclear power plant or a coal-fired power plant. That's a big order if you think of alternative energy. So when I set about to design these systems years ago, when I realized the numbers, I knew the scale of things, I knew what had to be done, and I chose wind. It's the safest, it's the most universal, it's everywhere, it blows during the day and night, doesn't depend on clouds. In fact, it usually is blowing better if there are clouds. It's a source of energy that is universal. And if you look at the entire amount of wind energy on the planet Earth in a given day, it's a vast amount of energy compared to our average daily usage generated from oil, coal, nuclear, and the other forms of energy. Wind is a tremendously capable source of energy, simply in terms of the quantity available. Solar is not. First of all, you only have a number of hours per day when it's useful, and then you have to capture it, then you have to have a day that's sunny. Okay, that limits us. And really, the solar collection and conversion equipment, the hardware, is not that productive. In other words, you're not going to get that much energy out of it, not enough to convert to build a system that's going to supply the entire world with its full energy needs. Solar isn't going to do it. Geothermal isn't going to do it. Geothermal is very specific to certain areas. It doesn't work every place. It's not practical every place. You can't come into the middle of a city. Well, you could, but it's going to be very difficult to provide geothermal. Although a city would be a good environment just because it's a concentrated region. But the end result is that geothermal, given everything that has to be done and the tremendous cost of putting in the infrastructure, the geothermal is not going to solve our worldwide energy needs. Putting bobbers out in the North Sea to create energy, electrical energy, simply isn't going to work. It cannot work on the scale necessary to replace the world energy needs. So at any rate, one by one in the book, I take all of the alternative energy systems that are out there, and I show why these are totally, totally inadequate, and drives that opinion in the public's mind that alternative energy is a weak, unsolvable problem. It's not going to create a solution for our energy needs. What I show is that it can and it will. And some of the feedback, by the way, I've gotten back from people that have responded regarding the book is that they're very happy, they're very excited. This has created a lot of excitement in the world. These books have gone every place. Now, I've seen the lists of where these books have gone. They've gone all over the world. There's probably not a country where these books have not been purchased by people. And in many cases, they're people, obviously, in fairly high levels in companies, corporations, etc. So this book is having its effect. It's already been seen. It's a book that's going to make a difference. And eventually, we have to come to the conclusion that yes, alternative energy can and will make a difference. It can be built on the scale necessary to power our world energy needs. And it can replace nuclear, coal, and oil oil primarily is not used in electrical energy, electrical generation. It is primarily used in automobiles for gasoline. But if we can power our gasoline, convert our gasoline motors for cars, convert those automobiles to electric, then all of a sudden we have a system in which we can utilize that tremendous amount of wind power converted directly to electricity. And that is my goal, is to convert the primary sources of electricity and to convert automobiles that are using gasoline into electricity. It's a very doable system. The technology, I couldn't have said this 10 years ago. I couldn't have said it probably 5 years ago. But today's technology, the battery technology, the automobile technology, it's very clear that this is a solution. And the thing that has been missing now is the ability to generate electricity naturally by some natural means. And the wind is the solution. It's a very powerful, available source of energy. The track record for nuclear, I don't have to go into a lot of detail about the devastating effects of nuclear pollution, the potential for damage that goes far into the future for generations and generations to come, or the damaging effects of coal, or say the fracking that's going on regarding natural gas, or the extraction of other types of energy from the ground. Burning fuel to create electricity or to move automobiles is going to be a thing of the past. That's simply the way it's going to be. And like I say, there's a tremendous amount of excitement in the public in response to this book. It really is a groundbreaking book in that not only it shows the designs to set up wing generation, I should call it, trying to get away from that wind word that has been so blackened by the three-blade wind generators, but the ability to build these on a scale necessary, that I just keep repeating that because it's so important to understand that this can be done. So I'm going to change gears a little bit here. Over the past week, I have been visiting some candidate locations for the wing generation projects, the large-scale 500 megawatt, 1,000 foot tall wing generator projects. And I tell you, I'm in places where the wind is just blowing every day, blows hard every day of the year. And the people, literally, they have to live to accommodate this because the way they put the doors on their homes, etc. The wind is blowing so hard in some of these locations, and it's at sea level or near sea level, to the point where the air is the densest, has the most effect, because density is one of the big factors. You don't want to put wind generators high up in the mountains or in high mountain passes, because the wind, even though it might be blowing harder, is less dense. So the best place is a place where you have steady wind, but at near sea level, if possible. And these places exist. I've been in a number of them this past week. But what's interesting is when I talk to people. There's an example here. I talked to a woman. She had a food stand. It was out in the country. And I stopped there for some food, and it was so windy. I said, "Is it like this all the time?" She goes, "Yeah, it's just every day, all year long, 365 days a year." And so I said, "You know, you really need a wind generator here." And she goes, "Yeah, we want to put one here, but the government won't let us put it here." And she said, "There's two down the road, big ones, you know, the 1.5 megabit type." And she said, most of the time they make them shut them down because it's too windy. They simply don't work. And I'm just like, I said, yeah, I know this is an absolute fiasco. And so this is the view of the public. But then I told her, I said, well, look, I have a new design for a system that really will work. It can withstand high winds, and it'll actually produce a lot of energy, and it doesn't have to be shut down when there's gusty winds or whatever. And she, the woman pulls out her business cards, and she says, you get me the information. This is the attitude of people. When they see what I'm doing, the public opens their eyes, their ears perk up, and all of a sudden, it's just like they understand that something major is happening here, that something major in terms of alternative energy, and not only that, but they want it, and they want it right now. So, and when I was on the show with Mary Heller the other day, she asked me, she said, now this all sounds great, but how soon can this be implemented? And the answer is that it can be implemented right away. This is not a pie in the sky 20 years down the road, or like the government agencies, by 2050, you know, we can have maybe a man on Mars. Well, geez, let's, you know, most people working on the project would be dead before they ever got it done. It's just a government ruse, most of the big projects you hear about. No, this project could be done. It could be implemented and completed within 3 years. We could be shutting down nuclear power plants as soon as a year and a half from now. We could be shutting down coal-fired plants within a year and a half. We could be going online. We could be using distributed energy. We could be putting battery packs in people's homes and controllers, and in, controllers in the neighborhoods. So to control the distributed energy concept, this is something that could be put in place now. As I said in the book, this, once again, the name of the book is McCanny Wing Generator, World Energy Project. This can be implemented in third world countries, and it's probably going to be implemented there long before you'll ever see it or hear about it in the news media in the major, what they, the so-called modern Western world, because the third world countries don't have anything to lose. They have a lot to gain. They can use these also for direct powering, for example, with desalinization plants, for reverse osmosis, to get clean water and have this done without electricity. This would, the wing generators would be directly driving major systems that could produce benefit to these societies, pumping water, moving fresh water to places that are arid. One of the things I talk about in the book is moving the floodwaters from the spring northern states in the United States down to the American Southwest. Now, the American Southwest, if you put water there, you can grow anything, any of the land in the American Southwest. All you need is water, and you can grow amazing crops there, but it lacks water. Right now, I've seen the devastation in the American Southwest. All of the reserves are low. The water tables are low in the all of the ponds, the lakes, the reserves, the holding reservoirs, etc., for water. All of them very low. So this is something that we can no longer wait to do. This is something that has to be implemented now. But the people in the leadership in this country just have their heads where the sun doesn't shine. That's the best thing you can say. They don't know anything. They don't know what to do. All they can do is talk about terrorism and more war talk and building up. You know, that's the only thing they can talk about. It's their only game in town, and it's getting... that stuck record is getting awful old, hearing that tune every night on the evening news. Something new has to take place. So at any rate, what I do in the background is I'm working not only on this, but on many other projects that are very necessary for the world. But this is a major one. Water, fresh water is another one. And there's draining the water out of Lake Yellowstone, for example, a major issue that has to be accomplished. Draining the water out of some of the major active calderas around the world, like the ones in Iceland, it's something that has to be done. But there again, you find scientists, I'm amazed at scientists, you see them going up to a volcano, like in Iceland, looking at it and go, yeah, if all this water drops down into the magma, it's going to blow up and turn into, expand 600 times into steam and blow the top off this mountain. But all you got to do is find a way to drain that water out, and then that won't happen. Now you're only dealing with a volcanic, possibly a very slow oozing lava flow. You're not talking about something that's going to wipe out half of Europe if it happens. But so the scientists also, I would say, are equally at fault for not coming up with real solutions. They're simply analyzing, looking at situations, and in many cases, as in the case of Yellowstone, the possibility of Lake Yellowstone or Yellowstone Lake dropping down in through a chasm down into the magma and turning into steam and converting that entire region into the biggest volcano the world has seen in 65 million years. The scientists are not helping, because nobody wants to say anything. Nobody wants to be the one to give the bad news. But I don't have to worry about that. I talk about whatever I want to talk about, and I'm not strapped by the concept of if I say this, maybe I won't get my pension or something. I don't have to deal with that, because I'm not ever going to get a government pension. I don't want one. I don't want to have anything to do with it. But that's the state of government science. They are so deathly afraid to say anything or say boo, because they might not get their hallowed pension, or they might get fired next year because their boss is afraid of having his department being the one to raise the red flag. That's what's going on in government science. They're all sitting in their little office, collecting their paycheck. Nobody wants to say boo, because, you know, they might not get their paycheck next week. I don't sit in that boat at all. Never did, never will. But the issue here is that moving the water, the floodwaters from the Midwest in the springtime, the Missouri River, the Mississippi River, divert that into the American Southwest using direct powered wing generators to move those floodwaters. That's a lot of water. It's going to take a lot of power, but also if the channels were built, then all you have to do is in a few pumping stations get it over some of the obstacles, and it will flow by gravity down to the rest of the American Southwest. Remember that just the Earth spinning is enough to cause a centrifugal force on the water that's flowing from north to south in the northern hemisphere. So taking that into account, and also the fact that we can move this water through the lower elevations from the upper Midwest down to the American Southwest and green that area. They're suffering from drought while one area of the country is being flooded. What insanity. But like I say, the politicians, you'll never hear anything intelligent out of those people's mouths, as there is no intelligence behind the mouth. They don't know anything. They don't know what to do. They're just trying to do the same things that everybody's done before. And as the old expression goes, if you keep doing what you've always done, you're going to keep getting what you've always gotten. And that's what this country is getting, is a bunch of political gobbledygook, and there's no leadership taking us into the real future, just the pretend future that's bolstered by the Washington politicians. So at any rate, the whole concept of using wing power for the benefit of man, there are many projects, there's some that I haven't really gotten online yet to talk about, but those are the big ones. If we get those accomplished, that'll basically cure about 99.9% of what's going on in the world today. and the rest of it we can take care of with a little bit of TLC, as they say, tender loving care. Right now, the ability to build these on a large scale, and this is what I started talking about at the beginning of the show, the ability to build these wing generators on a very large scale is already here. There's no, it's an engineering problem. We have all kinds of equipment built on this scale already around the world. The equipment that is made to work under high stress situations for long periods of times. Look at the ocean-going ships that carry cargo around the world, the oil tankers, immense projects that man is accomplishing all the time. So to convert to wing power, I should mention something, too, that this came out, and a lot of people have seen the pictures on the cover of the book now. And somebody came up with a misconception, and I thought, now how on earth could anybody possibly come up and misinterpret these pictures? But somebody thought that the wind would be coming in like a paddle wheel down the lateral cross-section of these wheels. No, the wind comes in broadside to the wheel. And the wings are set into the structure. Now, if that isn't clear, I'm not sure what would be, but that's the design. That's the intended design. This is not to act like a paddle wheel where the wind comes in laterally on the along the thin edge of the wheel. No, that's simply not the way it is. So if that's your misconception, please dispel it. Pronto. The wind comes in basically along the axis of rotation of the wheel. That's the direction of wind, and it has to be directed so the wind is always coming in pretty much along that line. Part of the engineering design is that the wings that are on these are self-adjusting, because if you have a 1,000-foot structure, the wings at the top of the structure might have a very different wind vector than the wings at the bottom. And so they have to self-adjust with the local wind, and that could be changing. It could be changing rapidly if it's a gusty day. And that's why the three-blade wind generators don't work. They're rigid. They can't react. And so part of the design, and this is a lot that goes on in the background, what the book really can't go into detail describing. The book is, understand, to give the general concepts to present that to the public. But when you get down to real designs that are working designs and you start building them on a 1,000-foot scale, there's some serious design work that goes into the background. And that's why when I was working back in 2005, then in 2009, to build prototypes, that's what the efforts were involved in, building and understanding some of these issues to scale, and then be able to build them up to a large scale. But like I've said before, as far as the engineering is concerned, there's no doubt that these can be built. Once we build them, start building them on that scale, it's a matter of reproduction and then simply maintaining them. There are how many generators in the, for example, the Hoover Dam? There are a number of, I think there was 7, as if I can remember correctly. But there were the number of electrical generators that turn to actually produce the electricity. The Hoover Dam at full capacity is capable of putting out over 2 gigawatts of power. That's very good, but right now it's not putting out anything because there's no water. If you go to that location, the wind that's passing by that location every day is easily, you could easily extract 2 gigawatts of power at the Hoover Dam using these wing generators. So that's one good example of a location where you have all of the power line infrastructure to carry that level of power out and distribute it to the local areas, and the long haul taking it out of the area. So putting a series of 4 to 6 of the large 1,000-foot scale wing generators near the Hoover Dam would be an ideal spot to start using this technology, to start tapping into the wind and then build that the ability to take that energy out of the region and distribute it, make it usable to the rest of the country. That's what this is all about. And then start building these installations around the country so we can float the grid at a specified level and then do the final tuning with controllers that are out in the network. That's the entire concept of distributed energy. That the energy, you're not trying to control the voltage or the current levels at the generator. You're controlling them at the usage, almost out where the power is being used, at the home or in the neighborhood or at a business. And, for example, like I've said before, I do this all the time. I live this life of distributed energy. I have not been on the grid myself for many years. I live with a voltage source that's not constant. My controller, what I use for my controller, can use a range of voltages, DC voltages that are 40% below normal or 40% above normal, and I still, at my equipment, in my living quarters, etc., I have a perfect 120 volt or 115 volt actually, 115 volt perfect sine wave all the time. So my equipment runs flawlessly. So the whole idea is that you do not need, in the current world of electricity, they try and control the electric power output at the generators, and that's the wrong place. They shouldn't have to worry about that in a distributed energy scenario. The control is out in the network at the usage point, and that's where it's best controlled, because if you try and control it at the power head, at the source of the power, you're going to simply always fail. You're never going to really be up to what you might call code or within small margins of electrical generation. The entire concept of distributed energy is going to be here. The concept of controlling voltage and current at the power generation source has to go away. It simply doesn't work. It's too hard to control. Obama wants to put in a smart grid to control energy and do more control at the source points. That's the wrong solution. And so, as I've said, I don't know what his science advisors are smoking out there, but their solution is simply not going to work. And eventually, this country, if they try and install a smart grid, by the way, what I see the smart grid, some company got an idea. They're sitting there waiting at the government trough, trying to get the politicians to sign on to it. And once they've signed on and they start building this, those companies are going to make a boatload of money. And after it's installed and does not work, then it's too late. The money's all been spent. Those guys are gone with the profits. And, you know, it's the same song and dance all over again. Somebody making big money off of big government projects that don't work. Simple as that. So that's the smart grid. The only thing the smart grid is going to do is measure and monitor the electrical usage of you, the public, and they want to do that as just another form of control. It's like Obamacare now controls your medical life, giving all that information to the government. You don't even own your body anymore because the government owns all the information, and that's what they want to do with power and electricity, is control every drop that you use and monitor it, because without electricity, most people do not function. But like I say, that's not me. I completely don't have anything to do with the grid, don't want to, never will ever again. So, and that's what I'm encouraging other people to do, is to get off the grid, create your own electricity, learn how to manage your own power, reduce your power consumption, and that's the way of the future. And once that starts happening, the centralized control grid, where with nuclear power generators, with coal power generation, it'll become much more difficult to control, because the people can simply leave and do their own thing. I'm just about out of time here. I want to remind you that the new book is called McCanny Wing Generator, available on the webpage. It's a little bit pricey, but there's a reason for that. The reason is because you're getting some technical information here. And we're starting also, just to let you know, the people are licensing this already. The response came in almost immediately that people are interested in the licensing of this, of the Wing projects. And so if anybody is interested, you better jump on the bandwagon quickly, contact us so you can get your licensing agreement. And there are already people off and running that are already, let's just put it this way, they're already on the program and very excited about it. So big things are happening behind the scenes, and this is the beginning of a new era relative to electrical power generation. Like I said, I'm going to have my own electric car. I'm going to have my own power generation for that car. And I will someday own stock in a large-scale wing generation, probably offshore facility, where I get my electricity for free because I've invested in a distributed energy generation tower. A lot to talk about here. But, the concept of centralized energy companies making big profits is a thing of the past. It's something that's going to go away. It's simply, I hope in 10 years, the kids that are growing up will read only about nuclear power in a history book. That'll be the biggest association they have with coal or nuclear or oil as far as energy sources, is to read about it in a history book. Just remember the webpage, jmccsci.com. That's seven letters, JMCC, S as in Sam, C as in Charlie, I as in Indigo.com. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour. And also remember the water filtration products. I have my line of name-branded water filter products, the best that you can find on the planet, at the webpage. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you next week. This is Jim McCanny. This is my Science Hour, and as always, we are at the crossroads. Good night.